be willing to bet that there's not many people in here that enjoy doing their driver's test. However, there might be a variety of reasons why we don't enjoy doing our driver's test. And for me, it is the silence of the driver's test. Now, what do I mean by that? Because obviously there's talking happening. Turn left there, pull over there, things like that. But what I mean by silence is you have no idea where you're at in the test. You have no idea if you're about to fail or if you're doing really well. Maybe you're a super confident person and you're like, I'm killing it, I know I am. Or maybe you're more pessimistic and you're like, I'm failing, I know I'm failing. But you have no idea from the driving instructor themselves. You simply, they don't pull over to the side of the road and say, hey, you know, you could do a little more shoulder checking, that would really help you here. No, they don't do that. You just go through the route, unless you really mess it up, of course. But unless you go through the route, you park back at the service center, and then all at once, all your mistakes fall on your head. And maybe you fail. Maybe you don't. No second chances. So it's the silence that gets to me. And I sometimes wonder what it would be like. I wonder if you do. What if God was like that? What if there was no guidance, no communication of what is pleasing to him, what is important to him, just silence. And then you die and judgment. What if God was like that? Sure, it doesn't feel good to be corrected. It doesn't feel good to open the word and say, you know, love is patient and kind. And you're like, yeah, not really me. That doesn't feel good. But isn't it better than silence? It is. It's better. And thankfully, we do not worship a silent God. He speaks and he tells us, if you want joy and hope and rest, you must live with Christ at the top, with him supreme over all. That if you want to run with and not against the course that this universe and all of history is moving, you will seek to recognize the rightful place of Jesus Christ as supreme above all. However, we are in an age of obscuring, one way to put it. That is, God's people are in an age of testing where forces are allowed to oppose and obscure the truth of Christ's supremacy overall. As a result, if we seek to live in accordance with this grand reality that nothing is above Christ, we are in for a fight. In for a fight. But it's worth it. Because only in living with Christ as supreme will we find joy, satisfaction, and relief that we crave. Which brings us to our main point this morning. We must seek relief by recognizing Christ's supremacy because it will be obscured. Now, these are long points, but there's only one word that changes in each one, so hopefully it will make it simpler. Number one, we must seek relief by recognizing Christ's supremacy, even as individuals obscure it. We must seek relief by recognizing Christ's supremacy, even as circumstances obscure it. And we must seek relief by recognizing Christ's supremacy, even as empires obscure it. Let's get started. Must seek relief by recognizing Christ's supremacy, even as individuals obscure it. Now for this theme, which I believe is very prominent, I'm going to grab different chunks of the text. It's hard to do 50 verses unless you want me to read the whole thing. So try and keep up. We're going to start with a recap. Last time we left Daniel and his friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that's not their Hebrew names, but that's what you might be familiar with, in a pretty good situation in Babylon. They had been exalted to positions of esteem and authority, and the text almost seems to suggest that they lived happily ever after. But we also talked about the fact that being in exile means that things are not all well. Things can turn pretty quickly on you when you're away from God's people, you're away from the promised land, and you're away from the center of the worship of Yahweh. And they do today. They turn very quickly. The scene opens in chapter 2 with King Nebuchadnezzar and a restless night. He has had some disturbing dreams, which he assumes are supernatural in nature for him and for the kingdom. This isn't a big problem, though. If you're king, you simply snap your fingers, and the top wise men, enchanters, diviners, Chaldeans, there's lots of names, but generally I'm going to call them diviners. The top diviners of the kingdom show up to give you an interpretation of the dream. There's one problem, though. The king won't tell them the dream. He wants the interpretation, but he also wants them to sort of read his mind, as it were. Now, if you read the text, it seems pretty clear that this is out of the ordinary. for whatever reason, the king decides that he's tired of putting so much confidence in these diviners and the answers they give. After all, you could basically make up whatever you want, and if you're vague enough, look, it came true. Sort of like horoscopes. Think of the horoscopes, right? You read your horoscope, and it's like, you will have an important decision to make this week. And later, you find yourself at Qdoba's trying to decide whether to put cheese on your burrito or not. And you're like, it's true! It totally read me! Right? If you're vague enough. And so the king is thinking something like this, and he goes, I'm tired of this. I'm tired of your vague sort of interpretations. Tell me the dream and the interpretation. That's my verdict. And you can almost picture these guys looking back and forth at one another awkwardly. You know, maybe he didn't hear us. Maybe he forgot or something. So like, yeah, just tell us the dream and we'll tell you the interpretation. No problem. But the king doubles down. No, tell me the dream and the interpretation. I think you guys are trying to buy time so to come up with a more sophisticated lie. And the Chaldeans, the wise men, the diviners, they double down. This is impossible. You can't. We don't know. Nobody knows, except if the gods were to come down and dwell with flesh, they might be able to tell you. But we can't do that. The king is not happy with this. He orders that not only this group, but all the diviners, all the wise men in Babylon are to be put to death. Now I want to pause for a moment here, because my first point is still up there. Obscuring Christ's supremacy is happening right here. I don't know if you noticed it or not. What is a better way to describe the king's behavior there than assuming the highest place, assuming the supreme place? Let's recap. He calls in the top diviners of the kingdom. He tells them they have to read his mind. And when they can't, not only they die, but everyone associated with their profession. Is he not acting like a little sovereign god with the power of life and death in his hands? He is. This is Nebuchadnezzar putting himself in the place of God, obscuring the supremacy of Christ. Now, we're at about verse 13 in the story, or in the chapter, and we're going to come back to it, but let me give you a quick summary. Daniel and his friends are diviners, so the captain of the guard, his name is Arioch, that's actually important, come to their house to take them away. Daniel convinces Arioch to explain what's happening, and convinces him to give him some time. I will come up with an answer. Just set a time for me to come. Daniel prays, receives an answer from God, and requests a time to bring the answer before the king. Now we're in verse 25. Daniel is brought before the king with the title, a man from among the exiles from Judah, who will make known to the king the interpretation. The king, likely a bit skeptical, just clarifies, can you tell me the dream and the interpretation? Yes, he can. And it's here we get the second part of the main point, recognizing the supremacy of Christ. This is simply a way of life for Daniel. It's his paradigm. This is the way he sees reality, Christ as supreme over all. Now, I want to pause that for a second. Some people might be confused at why I'm saying Christ for Daniel here, right? Daniel's not saying there's no Christ in there. You won't read Christ in Daniel chapter 2. But I'm functioning under the understanding of verses in the New Testament that say things like where Jesus says, Abraham saw my day and rejoiced in it. Things like that. Now, it's a little more complicated than that, but if you want to talk about it more, we can. The God of the Bible, the God of the Old Testament, is revealed as Jesus Christ. So I'm going to continue to use that name. Unpause. Now, when the king asks him if he can give the interpretation, Daniel cannot just give the interpretation. He cannot. He has to recognize Christ's supremacy. Now let's read what he says, and I want you to note the repetitiveness of how he speaks. This is verses 27 to 30. See how zealous Daniel is to exalt Christ over all. 27 to 30. Daniel answered the king and said, no wise men, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show to the king the mystery that the king has asked. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head and layer in bed are these. So you expect him now, he's going to tell them. No, he's not done yet. Verse 29. To you, O king, as you lay in bed, came thoughts of what would be after this, and he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what is to be. But as for me, this mystery has been revealed to me, not because of any wisdom I have, more than all the living, but in order that the interpretation may be made known to the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your mind. Daniel is zealous to give Christ the place of supremacy and preeminence, and he is wary of being put in that place. I believe also the text shows that there's a considerable risk that he took to say this and do this. If you look back at verse 10, you see the answer from the diviners. It says, "There is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand." There's not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand. And what does Daniel say? He says, "No wise men, enchanters, magicians, astrologers can show to the king the mystery that he's asked." So in other words, the thing that got the king so mad that he ordered the execution of all of them, Daniel repeats it. It's like he's saying, you know when you got all mad before about nobody being able to answer your request? Yeah, I actually agree with that. That was true. So there's a risk. But there's another risk. I think it's in verse 30. And Daniel says, God is sending him that you may know the thoughts of your mind. That's a little humbling, don't you think? You know the thoughts in your head? You don't understand them. You don't even understand what's going on in your own head. That's what he says to the king. You may rule over the entire world, but understanding your own thoughts is a mystery to you. Now, Daniel goes on to give the dream and the interpretation, which we'll come back to. But the hanging question should be this: how will the king respond? Daniel has just somewhat politely said, yeah, you had a big spaz over nothing, and you don't understand the thoughts in your head. How will the king respond? Verses 46 and 47. Then King Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and paid homage to Daniel and commanded that an offering and incense be offered up to him. The king answered and said to Daniel, "Truly, your God is God of gods and Lord of lords and revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery." How does he respond? He responds humbly. Now, I don't want to give too much affirmation to his response. It seems like he's still a little confused about where true power lies as he commands an offering to be given to Daniel. That's probably not quite kosher. Nevertheless, against all odds, Daniel's zeal to recognize Christ, even at great risk to himself, is repaid with honor and riches from the Lord. Relief in exile. Again, I want us to get this really clear. When Daniel went in before the king, everything around him would have been screaming, "Honor this guy. This is the path to safety. This is the path to happiness. Commend yourself to him. Do whatever it takes to avoid his anger and get his favor." But Daniel's focus is not on his own personal safety. Daniel's focus is not on his honor. Daniel's focus is on the honor and glory of Christ, and that is his controlling passion. We have to ask, what about us? What controls our interactions with other people when we feel the pressure? Say this, this is the way to commend yourself. Say that, this is the way to advance your reputation. This is the way to make this situation smooth and without bumps and charitable. What controls us? Is it a desire to honor and glorify Christ and bring ourselves low as Daniel does? Or is it a desire to esteem ourselves and forget about Christ? It seems like at this point we have to consider how we speak to those unbelieving neighbors, friends, family in our lives. Now, if you're anything like me, you have been berated endlessly for your lack of evangelical zeal. You know, you don't love the lost. You don't care about people going to hell. You don't really love Jesus. If you really loved Jesus, you would talk about him more. And on and on and on. Now, I don't think that's particularly helpful, and oftentimes it's not even biblical to berate people like that. However, there is one profoundly biblical, there's others, but there's one profoundly biblical and helpful one in this text. Speak to your unbelieving friends, families, and neighbors of the glory of Christ because he deserves it. Because he deserves it. Christ is the giver of life and breath and everything. Every moment we live is due to his tender, sustaining care in our lives. All our moments of warm friendship, health, wonder, and fun are gifts from his hand, and he deserves to be recognized and honored for these things. We should have a grief. Jesus Christ should be getting glory for that, and nobody's even acknowledging him as alive. That should be in our hearts. That zeal, that grief. Now, I'm not saying we all have to be downtown evangelizing, but we all have the command from 1 Peter chapter 3. In your hearts, honor Christ the Lord as holy, or as supreme. Always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you. Now, I'm not an expert on these things at all. In fact, I find myself shamefully incompetent as I'm talking to people sometimes, trying to get out what I'm trying to say. But let me give four suggestions to help us with this. Number one, you need to be diligent with your spiritual disciplines. You need to be diligent with your spiritual disciplines. If Christ is not in your heart, he won't come out of your mouth. Bible study, prayer, church attendance, fasting. I know you're not supposed to say fasting in North America. Fasting. If Christ is not in your heart, he won't come out of your mouth. Number two, I mentioned prayer, but let me suggest for prayer. If you find yourself not really getting to praying for your neighbors and your family and those things, set aside a single day. Wednesdays are the day for praying for the lost. Wednesdays are the day that I pray for my own heart toward the... I pray for opportunities. I pray for greater zeal to share. Set aside a day. If that's not your natural predisposition, set aside today. Number three, this is mostly in regards to building relationships. But one thing that I found surprising, maybe it's a Southern Manitoba thing, maybe it's just the people I talk to, but if you offer help to people, no thanks, I'm good. If you ask for help, sure, yeah, I'll come over Thursday. Yeah, you need some help with that. You need some help with your lawn. You need some help with your car. You need some help with your fence. People in Southern Manitoba love to help you with something. And think about it for a second. It's pretty humbling, right? I don't really know how to change the oil in my car. What guy wants to admit to his neighbor that he doesn't know how to change the oil on his car? What guy wants to admit that he doesn't really know how to fix his fence? It's humbling. You lay down the defenses. So, ask for help. Number four. Don't feel the need to limit your discussion to Christ and the gospel. Okay, let me explain before you take me out and burn me as a heretic. The tenets of the gospel, of course, are very important. Christ rules over all. We sinned. He died for our sins. If we receive him by faith as Lord, we get forgiveness. Know those things. Be prepared with those things. But I don't think that we need to feel like if you don't get in those tenets, you're a failure as an evangelist and you did not glorify Christ. How about this? Can I pray with you? You want to come to church with me? Would you like to read the Bible together? Can I tell you about how good Christ has been to me? You don't need to limit your discussion. All of these things are good. Bringing glory to Christ, setting him above all. But there's something we need to understand. We cannot simply rely on our behavior. Think of Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. What was Nebuchadnezzar ready to do? He's ready to offer sacrifices to Daniel and put Daniel in his pantheon of gods. And that's what our culture would be ready to do with you for your behavior. I know lots of nice people. You're one of them. I'll just put you up there with the rest. Yay. No glory to Christ. All glory to people. We need to speak. We need to have the words. Let's put our reputation and fate in the hands of a good father and focus on exalting Christ with our words and interactions with the world. So, number one, we must seek relief by recognizing Christ's supremacy even as individuals obscure it. They're going to get shorter, I promise. Number two, even as circumstances obscure it. We've had a look at the way Daniel recognizes and affirms the supremacy of Christ in the face of a powerful individual. But I believe verses 13 to 24 give us the opportunity to consider what could be done when a nameless, faceless circumstances come careening into our life. Imagine the circumstance for a minute. Daniel and his three friends are maybe having dinner. There's a knock at the door. "Hello, I'm Arioch, captain of the guard. Are there any wise men, any diviners here?" "Well, yes, we're all employed as diviners for the king." "Okay, I need you all to come with me to be executed." That's a bad day. That's out of nowhere. Right? There's a face associated with it, but he's just a messenger. You can't do anything about it. He doesn't have to give you a reason. He doesn't have to give you a warrant. He doesn't have to explain anything. He just comes in. "You guys are all dead. Thank you very much. Have a nice day." Now, we're not exactly told what Daniel says, but it's very similar to chapter 1. It says he answered shrewdly, and he got out of Arioch. "What's happening? What's happening? Why is the king's demand so urgent?" And he explains it to him, and then Daniel says, "Hey, I can give you the answer to this, and I can spare all these guys' lives." Now, in chapter 1, we saw him give another shrewd response. "Test us for 10 days with only vegetables and see if we are less healthy than the other young men you've brought in." Daniel submissively, shrewdly speaks, and the most important thing, trusts that God is in control. If you read it, he doesn't have an answer yet. He tells Arioch, "I'm going to have an answer for you." He doesn't have one yet. He's trusting that God will provide. Then Daniel goes and prays with his friends that God would reveal the dream and the interpretation. And this leads to Daniel's prayer of praise, which Chad read. And I want you to understand that this is the summary of the whole chapter right here. These are the themes we are meant to take away from this short passage. Let's read it again. We're going to just go from 20b, starting with blessed, down to 23. Here we go. "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells with him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise. You have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter." Let me summarize it in an even more concise way. The God of all power and knowledge gives to those who recognize him as such. In other words, the God of all power and knowledge gives to those who come to him saying, "You are the God of all power and knowledge." That's a summary. Now again, this is the climax of the story. In Western stories, the climax is at the end. Often in the Bible, it's in the middle. The rest of the story doesn't add anything. It just unpacks in story form the points that are made in this little poem, prayer. He raises up kings and empires. He gives wisdom and knowledge to people. He brings down kings. He lifts them up. He gives insight to feeble men. And this is what we're going to see. This is what we've seen the rest of the story. Now, there's very few of us that are going to have a government official knock on the door and say, "I'm going to take you to be executed." I know you think the government's bad. Some of us think the government's really bad. But that's likely not going to happen. However, many of us have had and still will have this kind of sudden jolting announcement. "I'm sorry, but it's cancer and it's terminal. I'm sorry, your son needs a series of surgeries and I don't know if he'll ever recover. I'm sorry, but there is no heartbeat." This is, in a manner of speaking, Arioch knocking at the door, telling you that you're going to experience some kind of death. And he's not the one in charge. He's just a messenger. You can get mad at him. You can try and threaten him. But it won't change anything. What does it look like to embrace Daniel's paradigm of the situation? Seeing Christ as supreme over all, in control of Arioch, in control of the guy above him, and the guy above him, and the guy above right to the top. What does it look like to exalt Christ, to see the whole situation and events under the control of Christ for the exaltation of the name, of his name and the good of his people? Now, back in 2019, my wife Alana had been carrying our second child for about 9 weeks. We went to the doctor with some concerns about the pregnancy, and we got one of those Arioch moments. There is no heartbeat. Now, this isn't new. I shared quite publicly a blog post I posted on Facebook, but I think there's a couple of things that bear repeating here. And I'm mostly going to come at it from, this is what I did, which was not exalting Christ, and this is how I tried to turn away from that. So the first impulse I had when I heard this news was I was grasping for control. It's an impulse many of us will have when we face tragedies, trying to grasp for control. We may need outside help to even recognize it. But for me, in the miscarriage, it looked like a tsunami of thoughts like, next time I'll be more careful what we eat. Next time I'll pray more fervently. And I really felt ashamed that in my head I was moving on to next time already. But I didn't really, I don't think, need to be ashamed. What I needed to recognize as I was trying to do, I was trying to feel some sense of control in a situation where I was not in control at all. We see this attitude come up with COVID. Put up signs like, we got this. I've mentioned that a couple of times. Or stick it to COVID. We are not in control. But these are the ways we try to deal with that sense of out of control. Now, Daniel is an example. He didn't pray first right away. He did negotiate shrewdly. He made plans. But it's clear that Daniel was relying on God to deliver him, and we must seek to do that as well. So what should I have done instead of trying to think, next time I'll do this, next time I'll do this? I should have found rest in who God is. He's sovereign. He loves perfectly. He's wiser than I will ever be. Rather than entertaining these thoughts of next time I got to fix this, and rather than doing that. One more. I'm going to call this seeking comfort and probability. This is something that I was drawn towards as well. Now, again, I mentioned in my blog, not long after the first loss, I started to feel apprehensive about, should we try again? What if this keeps happening? How many times before we just stop and give up? How many times is God going to let us go through this? The false comfort that swept in immediately from my own heart and sadly even from other Christians was the comfort of what I'll call probability. Sounds like this. What are the odds of that happening again? Look at your family history. That's probably not going to happen. If you've been diagnosed with cancer, it might look like reciting in your head these statistics of, well, you know, 5 out of 8 people with your kind of cancer do recover from this. That's comfort and probability. Those are the things that you go to when anxiety strikes, when fear strikes. You recite those things in your head. Or maybe you're just a really optimistic person that just kind of says everything's going to be fine. You're not thinking why everything will be fine, but you just, everything will be fine. That does not exalt Christ. Again, what exalts Christ is drawing comfort from the certain reality of his love. He is good. No matter what, you're a Christian. You will stand with him in eternity. You will look back over every choice that he made to pull back the comfort and protection and allow these things to happen, and you will say thank you. You will. You will say thank you for doing it your way and not my way. It's hard to imagine. We will. It's scary to do this. If you've always relied on probability, it's really scary. This has happened this morning. This is going to go long, but this morning I went to go to work. I was here at 7 o'clock. And I had this thought in my head, maybe you should just double check for your keys because nobody's going to be there. And I went and they were on the hook. And that terrified me. Why? Because why did I remember it? Was it because I was so diligent? Was it because I was so smart? No, it was because God reminded me. And it's scary to just go, you do it, God. It's your way. It's scary. But probability will fail you as a comfort. it will fail you. It is a false god. We all have a 100% chance of dying. And if we don't trust Christ in that, we all have a 100% chance of spending eternity in anguish and torment. Trust Christ. He is good. All the things that happen will be for a good purpose, for our joy. He's worthy of our trust. I could go on and on here. I'm trying to stop. But if you've had Ariac knock on your door in the past few months with heart-stopping news, I would urge you to seek relief in the exaltation of Christ rather than the comforts of this world. Last point. Must seek relief by recognizing Christ's supremacy, even as individuals obscure it, even as circumstances obscure it, even as empires obscure it. Now, I mentioned earlier to be digging in to verse 31 to 45, Daniel's interpretation of the dream. We're going to do that now. Here we go. King saw a statue, 4 or 5 parts, depending on how you split it. Head of gold, chest and arms of silver, middle and thighs of bronze, legs of iron, and feet of clay mixed with iron. As the king was taking in this terrifying statue, he saw a stone was cut, but not with human hands. It hit the feet of the statue and broke it in pieces. But then the entire statue crumbled, not just into small pieces, but almost like crushed into fine dust that was blown away by the wind, leaving not even a trace. The stone, however, grew and grew until it covered the whole entire earth. Now the interpretation, it's a little bit of exegesis from what we know now. The statue represents an age of the earth, starting with the time of Daniel, ending with the empire in which Christ is born, lives, and dies. The head of gold is the kingdom of Babylon. Shoulders and the arm, chest and arms, the Medes and the Persians. The bronze, legs and thighs, is the Greek Empire, and the legs and the feet is the Roman Empire. The rock striking the feet is the first coming of Jesus Christ and his kingdom, perhaps referring to his entire life, perhaps referring to his birth only, probably his entire life. That kingdom falls. But the kingdom, the people of God, the rock that strikes the feet grows and grows and grows. And we are in the middle of that right now. We're in the middle of the growing. The rock has grown, is growing, and will grow and eventually take over the whole earth. And all other earthly kingdoms will become like dust scattered to the wind. Let me read just the last couple of verses. You gotta hear them. 44 and 45. And in the days of those kings, God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. Just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces, the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, a great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation sure. Waverly, we are prone to get caught up in the God-obscuring empires we're in the midst of. Let's consider a few things to get perspective. Rome was the legs and feet of the statue that was crushed. It's not possible to pinpoint the exact length of the Roman Empire, but a conservative guess would be 1,000 years, how long the Roman Empire was in power for. You know how long the United States of America has been a country? Less than 250 years. The thing that we think is going to go on forever, that's enduring for all time, is less than a quarter of this empire that is long gone. The culture we understand and see around us with old things like cars, baseball, grocery stores, etc., are even younger than that. And I think if you and I were honest, we would say that most of the time we live as though these things are going to last forever. They're not. They're not. We need to realize also that we are surrounded by forces that are trying to subtly convince us that we are the climax of history. If you watch any sporting event, you're almost certainly going to hear things like, are we seeing the greatest defensive linebacker in history today? History? How long has football even been a sport? You'll hear things like, this is the first time that these colors have been worn at this stadium. They're just putting those things into your head, into your heart nonstop. The news is doing that all the time. First time in history for that. First time in history for this. This is the most snow we've ever seen in a single January. This is the hottest July on record. How long have they even been keeping records? 150 years in Manitoba. That's nothing. First time in history? Garbage. They don't even know. Commercials are obviously terrible for this as well. First car ever with a fifth sunroof. First mop with a carbon fiber handle. First spatula made out of all recycled material. First, best. This is the time in history that everything matters and everything else before didn't matter. It's being drilled into you day after day. Now, the last time I preached, I urged us to cut down on our media intake, which I'm mentioning again, but in a more specific way. Because some of us think, you know, stay away from the violence, stay away from the sex, and you're good. But it's all around us, no matter what you watch. Even the most innocent of TV watching will strengthen the sense that the world is all that is, it will go on forever, and if we don't posture ourselves well in this culture, then we are fools. But the Bible says the opposite. John 12:25. Whoever loves his life will lose it, but whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. That's the opposite of the message you will get from our culture. So yes, I would say again, make sure your recreational media time does not overtake your time with those people and things that are centered on God's eternal kingdom. I will add one thing that I think has fallen into a lot of disrepute. Read church history. I think among many in the church, this idea has fallen into scorn. Reading church history is this boring thing that arrogant, self-righteous theologians do. But I would commend to you the reading of church history or listening to it in audiobook form. And I'm sending out some resources with the email this week so you can get some suggestions. Waverly, the story of the church is our family story. It's the story of the Spirit of God moving through the ages, preserving, strengthening, overcoming. The Spirit of God has not spoken to you alone in all of church history. He's spoken throughout the ages, slowly revealing who God is by increments, more and more, allowing people to go off course here and off course there, but continually moving forward our knowledge of the infinite God. It's glorious. These are our grandfathers and our grandmothers of the faith. It's our story. You will see, reading church history, this very thing playing out, the rock that smashed the statue getting bigger and bigger and bigger to one day take over the whole earth. If you have your solid, consistent time in the Word, this should not replace the Bible. Let me be clear on that. But if you have your solid, consistent time in the Word, I would commend you the reading of church history. You will see God's hand and work through the ages and grow in your faith that He will hold us to the end. As we close, I want to go back into a pretty scary situation for the people involved that we went over fairly quickly, and it's in verse 10. It says, "The Chaldeans answered the king and said, 'There is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand, for no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh.'" So here are these men, desperately pleading with the king for their very lives. There is no way to get knowledge and understanding that you crave. It's impossible. These men know the only way they can be saved. Do you see it? They need the gods to dwell with them and make the mysteries of the universe known. That is the only way they can be saved. The wrath of the king. Of course, in the story, Daniel, as it were, mediates the presence of God among flesh, so to speak, and saves not only his own life, but the lives of all the wise men, the diviners. However, this is a small problem. This is a problem limited to Daniel and Babylon. There is a bigger problem in the entire world, and that is, there is not just a little weak King Nebuchadnezzar on a throne. There is a God on the throne of the universe, and He is righteous. And instead of ridiculous, arrogant demands, he has life-giving, humble requirements on us to walk according to his statutes and rules. Statutes and rules that we have scorned again and again. Will God be silent on this matter? Will we come to the end of our lives and just get the report? Will he speak again? He will, and he has. He has spoken again. We do not worship a silent God, one that judges according to his holy standards at the end of our lives with no guidance or help along the way. As we've been learning in the book of John, the Word of God became flesh. He spoke again. He spoke into the darkness of our futile efforts to find happiness and wisdom and to please God. He has spoken in and through his Son. This is the time of year that we celebrate, isn't it? 2,000 years ago, the Word of God became flesh and came into the world. The rock was cut out, yet not with human hands, and it struck the foot of the statue. That's what happened. The rock that would grow and grow until it covers the whole earth. That is the day we celebrate in Christmas, in a way. Now, if you have not submitted your life to Jesus Christ, the Word made flesh, the cornerstone that the builders rejected, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, I would urge you to do that this morning. He came as a baby, lived a perfect life, no sin. For sinners like you and me, he died so that we could be part of the growing kingdom rather than continue to be allied with the kingdoms that are turning to dust. Receive his forgiveness, his death in your place, and his righteousness, and you will live in a kingdom of everlasting joy, the kingdom that will be the only kingdom left on the earth forever, reunited with your King. Please do that today if you have not before. Talk to the person you came with if they're a Christian. Talk to me, one of the pastors. We would love to pray with you or hear any of your thoughts on this. Let's pray.